Anyway, yeah. I'm digressing. We were talking about introductions. And yes. Seeing as I've been yabbering on, and this was kind of my idea, and I'm recording it and whatever.
You go first?
I'll go first, unless you want to go first.
No, that's all right. You go first.
Okay, I'll go first. My name's William. Maybe I'll tell you my last name at some other point. Not that it's hard to find out. It's actually William Connor. So it's there. I did it. I don't know. I ego trip. I mean, you put my name into Google.
Come out into the light, Will. Come out into the light.
WilliamConnor.ca is my website. I don't know why I'm afraid of it all of a sudden. But anyway, that's me. I'm 33, live in Calgary, Canada. Yay, home of the Flames, the Calgary Stampede, all that wonderful stuff. And
it is wonderful.
Never mind. We can debate about the Stampede later.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got you on record saying that. So, and Bob and I guess it's Robert now. Sorry.
Rob
and I have been friends for well over way too long. 15 years? No.
Something like that. No, it's been pretty close.
Yeah.
We met once online and I didn't realize it was you. And then I was hanging out with the lot in Brentwood. And I think that's the first time we met in person.
The house that they should have sterilized when we all moved out. They probably.
Yes. Oh, the house they should have sterilized.
I almost wonder if it would have been better to have a grow up in there versus what there was like 9 of us at one point.
Was that true? Because I never lived in the house when there were that many people. Although I think I lived in the house when there were 6 or 7 at the most when I was there.
Maybe it was 7. I'm trying to think. When I was there, there was 6 or 7 of us too.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Jeez. Anyway. Well,
fair enough. But there were a few of us who were core, including who has yet to show up. And then there were a whole bunch of people that just came and went. And that always caused interesting times.
And very widely divergent people living together, all 18, 19, 17.
Unless they were married. Which was interesting.
Right.
Were you there when we had a couple married couples or almost married couples living?
No, I think that was more your time as I left and you came, right? So.
Yeah, that's true. Although you graced us with your presence on a regular basis.
Well, there you go.
So.
So yeah, the three of us, Bob and I have lived together on and off. Jason's been my roommate a couple times throughout the years. And, geez, I wish he was here, but, you know, whatever.
He'll wander in and we will welcome him.
The last 5 minutes.
Yes.
He'll be like, okay, I'm ready to go.
Sorry, buddies.
Yeah, so this is going to be like the most boring thing for anyone to listen to. But that's just, whatever.
Yes, no dead air.
Let's you know, develop our personalities and whatnot as we go. Or express them, I should say.
Yes, I was going to say, wow, we've had many years to develop our personalities. The question is whether they come across.
Right.
Indeed. So should I introduce myself now?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so my name is Rob Walker, and I live in Toronto, Canada, by way of Winnipeg, by way of Calgary, by way of Airdrie. And I am currently a long-distance PhD student in theology at University of Birmingham in the UK. That's pretty much my life at the moment.
You want to be a preacher when you grow up?
I do want to be a preacher when I grow up, and a good scholar and a good writer. And I had a good friend of mine, she scowled at me. This was a middle-aged colleague of mine. And she goes, oh, you said good scholar, not successful scholar. And you said good writer, not successful writer. Good luck. And I was like, oh, thanks, you know. But apparently there's a distinction, so.
Well, you know, 50 Shades of Grey, that's all I'm saying.
Oh, I also have a BA in English, you know, that took me many years, but the last year was from Canadian Mennonite University in Winnipeg. And so I fully own that this makes me a terrible English major, but I actually tried to read The 50 Shades of Grey. So I got the first one and I was like, okay, I want to see what all the fuss is about. There's nothing to fuss about at all. It's abysmal. I read 5 pages and went, I could write better than that.
So you got through the first shade.
Yeah. That's it. That's it. And it was just, it was abysmally written. And the history as a fanfic was still wildly evident. And I was like, this is awful. And this is supposed to be the bestseller of the summer. And people are talking about bondage and domination and all this sort of stuff because of this, you know, mainstream story. And I'm like, oh, shoot me now, says the pacifist. You know, it was bad.
Well, you know, I can't cop to having read it. It just didn't quite seem like my type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like my fiction to have a little more substance.
I was subtly hoping there would be some substance, because I'm like, why are these books selling like hotcakes? But there was none. So.
Now, did you hear, and I don't know if it was Reddit or some other online community. I'm pretty sure it was a Reddit community, but I could be wrong. If I am, forgive me. There is a group of people who each independently wrote a few pages of a chapter or a chapter along the lines of 50 Shades of Grey. It was rather random and unstructured, and they posted on Amazon, and it's been doing incredibly well, even though it's not at all cohesive.
Oh,
it was kind of more like a you know, media on demand type of thing. And
right, were they trying to, was it supposed to be a satirical sort of thing about 50 Shades and now it's selling really well? Or
I think the basic premise was, you know, a million monkeys and a million typewriters, and whoever thought of the idea had access to this internet community and put that into motion and came up with something relatively popular. I understand that they're, and you know, if my microphone wasn't directly in front of my keyboard, I'd actually look it up, but sure. It'd make a lot of noise if I did. I understand that their initial idea was that it wasn't really going to make any money. It was just for a lark, and it's become successful enough that they've had to start figuring out how they're going to compensate the authors.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, just a little comment on your good versus.
Yes, successful. Yeah.
Right. Not yes, necessarily indeed. The same things.
No. But I do still stick by, I would like to be a good preacher, good writer, and good scholar when I grow up. So hopefully I'm on the way with all three.
I think that you could be there. I've read some of your stuff.
Well, thanks.
It's definitely doable, I guess.
You know, whether or not you agreed with most of the stuff you read is probably a different and very textured conversation.
Textured, I like that. Well, which kind of brings us to the other point of why are we here and what are we doing, right?
Yes.
So our conversations, the three of us, when we get together, and I think this the idea for this podcast really for me stemmed from our last meeting when you were in Calgary, and the three of us one of our old habits was to occupy a booth at Denny's for an evening and debate theology and morality and ethics and the events of the day. And yes. I think there'd been about a 7-year gap since we'd done that last, maybe
That's
more.
True. That's true.
And the three of us got together and we picked up a booth in Denny's, and I swear to God, it was like an hour had passed.
Yeah, it happened again.
Yeah.
You know?
So we figured that, you know, maybe we could bring this, share our ignorance with the world on a massive scale. And that's kind of the whole point behind this. Tends to be more of a libertarian conservative type character.
Mm-hmm.
You as a theologian, albeit liberal, tend to still structure your ethics and morality around Christian ideology.
Mm-hmm.
Myself, I kind of just go go with what works at the time. So our thought is someone sort of on the right, somebody sort of on the left, and somebody sort of in the middle.
It was funny because about that, like, most people when they encounter me are going to assume that I'm on the left, and I hope the way that I describe it to people, they say, where are you politically? I say, I hope I'm radical, but I tend to jump from the left. So I don't know if that makes any sense, but I tend to decide issue by issue by issue sort of where I am. But I suppose it's accurate that I'm mostly on the left. I just wanted to make a minor protest because I remember some of the suggested topics, one of them being about whether gay rights actually exist. Was that? I think that was one of the potential topics.
Right.
Human rights.
Yeah.
You know? And so I was thinking that there was surprisingly going to be some pretty strong agreement because I don't actually think human rights exist, which is a terrible thing to say when you're a liberal preacher, but there it is.
Okay, well, expand upon that.
Well, here it is. I think that human rights are premised on the idea that morality is universal and that there's also something universal and transcendent that describes what a human being is. And so once you do that, it just becomes a matter of applying these things that are self-evident to to human communities or to human individuals. Except that those assumptions are liberal philosophical ideas that can only be enforced by liberal democratic states. And liberal democratic states don't acknowledge transcendence. And so basically it reduces to human rights are what liberal democratic states say they are. And if they change their minds or slide to the right or wherever you want to comment on the political spectrum, states can all of a sudden remove these supposedly self-evident human rights.
Which makes them more privileges.
Yes. And arbitrary.
Right.
Or relatively arbitrary. So the idea, human rights as we talk about them appear stable, but only if you have liberal democratic institutions that agree they should exist in that form. As soon as they disappear, so do your alleged human rights.
So would you think that human rights are a luxury of resource stability?
Huh. I've never been asked the question that way before.
So my thinking along that is, that human or rights, as we tend to think them, are very much a luxury of the West.
Okay.
You know, we tend to be the thought leaders in this. And I think that that's something that comes about largely because we don't have the pressures, or at least the same pressures. And maybe I'm talking out of my ass, and I often do and will, but yes. I tend to formulate my thoughts as I go. I really don't think ahead on too much. I think that it seems to me that when your major concerns are, fitting into Maslow's basics, the shelter, the food, that such things as freedom of speech aren't really so much of a concern to you or your state.
Sure.
That you're more concerned of, is the army going to show up in my village and rape me and pillage me or...
Right, right.
That type of thing?
Yeah, I hear that.
And I wonder if in a situation where, say, a Western country, and I've kind of thought about this myself, So let's take Canada,
Okay. We live here.
Yes. And it's easier for us to comment on than other systems, although, Western Euro-American centric stuff is pretty consistent.
Yeah.
Or fairly consistent anyway. But let's take Canada. It strikes me that if we were resource deprived, we were facing economic hardship, many of our freedoms to, say, privacy, to assembly, stuff like that, which are fundamental rights in our Constitution, although that's debatable. We can debate the first line of our Constitution at some other point. would seem a luxury that wouldn't necessarily fit in line with the greater good and general order.
Right, right. Well, there's always a certain... Yeah, it's sort of funny. Like, where my mind goes with that is I was sitting in, it was basically a philosophy class, but the prof was talking about how René Descartes, right, the one who said, I am, I think, therefore I am,
mm-hmm.
he basically conceptualized human beings as brains on a stick, was his joke. And what he meant by that was that Descartes believed that you could take one step back from all of your socialization and your ego, which is the space behind your eyes, if you want to put it that way, can make decisions that are independent of your tradition, independent of your bodily experience, independent of everything except for strict rationality. Okay. And there was a woman colleague of mine in my class who stuck her hand up and said, Descartes would have had a very different position if he had been a pregnant woman. So I guess what I'm trying to say with that is that where you actually are in the world, like you said, are we better resourced and therefore we can generate these ideas of human rights? I think circumstances and history have quite a bit to do with how you rationalize things that we now call human rights. And if we didn't have that history, we wouldn't be dealing with the same set of problems. So the more privileged you are or the more relaxed your society is, the more likely you are to develop complex philosophical systems like human rights.
But, and again, it's that term right, I think, is where, I mean, I would agree with you, but I think that the term right is kind of where what we're really focusing on here, right? Is, so when we talk, we as in, you know, el publis, the public at large.
Okay.
My Latin sucks, so whatever. But, sorry, I haven't studied it.
When the hoi polloi, sit down for a chat.
I think, you know, let me speak for Joe on the street because I'm hardly qualified to do so. And sorry, I'll stop. Let me get to the point here.
That'll be the first of many puns, folks. Oh, many puns.
Okay, so... I would submit that most people, when you say that X is a right, that it's inassailable, irrevocable, right?
That is what we mean, I think, yes.
But in practicality, or in practice rather, that doesn't really hold water. I think of things like habeas corpus, something that's fundamental to our judicial system,
right,
which the Americans saw fit to do away with for a period of time in certain circumstances.
And still do in certain others, is my understanding.
Right, right. Yes. Or even, you know, one thing that just baffles my mind is this idea that has cropped up within our Western system of when you are on a border, you are in this no man's land where the rights of your country or the receiving country don't apply. Right? So as we are walking into the United States, we're subject to unreasonable search and seizure, detainment without rights to a lawyer, all these other things. You have no protections of the United States Constitution at a United States border crossing, which for some odd reason can actually extend several miles past the border checkpoint. It's not as fluid here in Canada, but Customs still has the right to search you, and for you can reason that there may be good reason for them to do that to protect people, tariffs, right, agriculture, all these other things. I mean, there are definitely good reasons for customs. But when I think of a common situation that seems to be happening a lot in the United States is the seizure of laptops when people refuse to disclose passwords to customs officials. To me, that doesn't make a lot of sense. I have the right not to incriminate myself, especially in the United States, more so than here.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the right to remain silent, and I have the right to be protected against unreasonable search and seizure. Yet when I walk through a border checkpoint, say to board a plane or whatnot, it is within the legal rights and ability of a TSA agent to ask me for all that information, if not to deny me entry, place me under arrest, or seize my property. Or all of the above. I mean, I wouldn't expect American rights to apply on the Canadian side of the border. Obviously, I understand the issues of sovereignty. But it seems to me that when you're dealing with a U.S. official or a Canadian official or a U.K. official, that their constitutional rights, protections, and privileges should apply to you the second that you're on their soil.
It would seem logical.
So, yeah, it's that whole assailable thing. So, you know, if we can't even guarantee our citizens or our visitors that we won't ask them to rat on themselves or that we won't search them or take their stuff for no reason, then how can anyone honestly expect the right to, you know, personal sovereignty, if that's out of the way? How can anyone honestly expect that a state is going to stand by the idea that a person has a right to live?
Yes, indeed. Do you know, it's interesting because even though lots of different Western nations, and in Canada, unfortunately, it's only in our criminal code, but there are definitions of personhood, you know, in Western jurisprudence or, you know, lawmaking or in philosophy, and we can find these definitions, except that it usually means that persons are citizens. And not all bodies within your borders are citizens. our citizens don't even have all the rights that we think are unassailable. Never mind bodies that are not citizens within our borders.
So you're alluding to the personhood of corporations.
Well, I didn't realize I was, but please continue. This fascinates me.
That's what I assumed that you were going for. And maybe you have somewhere else that something else that you were thinking or somewhere else that you were headed.
Well, but, fair enough. Go ahead.
You know, this is a uniquely American creation and export to the rest of the world, where I think it was RCA who first enjoyed the privilege. Oh, sorry about that. RCA first enjoyed the... you know, I'd have to double check that. It doesn't matter. The United States Supreme Court has decided that corporations are persons under the law, with few exceptions, so they don't have the right to vote.
Right.
But they do have the right to free speech. And they do have the right to exist and the right to purchase property. And it really changed our idea of what a corporation is and how the corporate charter worked. I really wish I knew my history better. I don't know if it was railroads or broadcasting was the industry that did it. It was one of the two. But prior to that, a corporate charter would be issued to complete a specific task. And once the task was done, the corporate charter would be dissolved. So if you were an engineering company or a group of engineers and you wanted to build a bridge, you would form a corporation for that purpose.
So it was task oriented. And then, so if I hear you correctly, whereas before a corporation was a task oriented entity that would dissolve at the end of the task, being our brothers and sisters in the United States, I guess, have decided that corporations are enduring entities that are equivalent to human persons in a lot of ways.
With a few exceptions, yes.
Yes.
I think the rationale originally was, you know, we can build a railroad, but how do we then maintain it and operate it, right? So we need an everlasting charter. And you kind of get this mission creep that has come up from them. Like, well, you know, if we are a corporation, we need the opportunity to be able to purchase land and hold it for the development and betterment of our enterprise. And then this idea of corporate personhood became bestowed. And from there, I think it's really perverted. We now have these entities which are completely unaccountable. multinationals, and I can't believe I'm going down this road. But I mean, there's this linear path from this initial Supreme Court decision bestowing corporate personhood to these corporations which are larger than the governments of the countries in which they serve and are accountable to really nobody. I mean, their economies are larger than any group of citizens could ever hope to withdraw from. And they obviously don't answer to a celestial power, let alone a state power.
Well, fair enough. Once you reach that level of complexity, my tradition, the Christian tradition, often calls that empire, or sometimes the principalities and powers, because, you know, it's not, as you said, it's almost impossible, if not impossible, to withdraw from the reach, the creep of these corporations or multinationals, for example. And they're not accountable to any structure or power, I guess, that's set up underneath them, because those same structures that are supposed to keep them accountable are complicit in the empire's operations. So yeah, there's no accountability. Yeah, I'm not afraid, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't really have the energy to be a conspiracy theorist, but I think what concerns me is, from where I sit, people's bodies. You know, I'm going to be wearing a collar or not, and people will come visit me with their problems, and they will be very real world sort of things. And then we call a corporation the same sort of entity. And it just seems fundamentally backwards, because we can't even guarantee allegedly basic human rights to actual bodies who live within Canadian borders. And then we're so interested in defending the human rights of corporations.
Right.
Well, who are very good at manipulating bodies, if you haven't noticed.
And this brings it full circle, right? What are the inalienable rights? And it seems the rights of the corporations tend to trump the... Okay, and I'm really not anti-capitalist, so these are kind of hard statements to make. But in a lot of situations, when you take the idea of how IP law and copyright law is being designed and enforced, it is to the benefit of a corporate entity, intellectual property.
Okay, thanks.
No, that's fair enough. I mean, if you have a question, I'm sure somebody else does, so never be afraid to ask it. Yeah. I sure will. A way a lot of that, and these are things that, you know, directly affect our culture, like how do we create and how do we communicate and how do we distribute culture, right? Mm. Like these are fundamental to who we are as a society and what our values are, our ideas of privacy and whatnot. And if they're controlled legislatively by a few bodies that are protected. I mean, I don't have a problem that Viacom exists. I have a problem that there's only five media companies which control the majority of our cultural input and creation and distribution within North America.
Gotcha. You know,
we realized that earlier on when we had caps on how many newspapers you could own and how many telephone companies you could own and how many radio stations you could own, and because we didn't want one group of people dictating the narrative to the masses. Mm. And the internet has alleviated a lot of that. But, you know, to say that we're not victims is the word I want to use, but it's not the right one.
Right.
To say that we're not consumers of mass culture and broadcast culture, I don't think any of us can get away with it. Even if we don't participate in TV, we associate with those who do. Right. And there is kind of that pressure to know that maybe you don't watch Jersey Shore, but you still kind of know some of the crap that went on there.
It's in the cultural lexicon, sort of. Kind of like for lots of people who hate Star Trek, right? Still no Beam Me Up, Scotty. It's the same.
Never said, but whatever.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
You know, but they know about, you know, I get to beam somewhere.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, it's the same sort of thing, and I think that's right. Yeah, I don't quite know where to go with that, but I get worried too. I was just thinking that if we wanted to have, because issues like this will come up dozens and dozens of times for us three, I'm sure. A good friend of mine who I met recently, his name is Matty Bowman, and he's actually a media scholar and a human rights scholar, both at the undergrad. So he's got this lots of fascinating stuff about surveillance regimes and stuff like that on Facebook, and sort of how Facebook causes people to negotiate their identities in certain ways, like closetedness. When you're on Facebook, you know, you're not half out of the closet on Facebook. You either don't have a relationship status or you do, and it's perfectly clear,
right,
where you are. Stuff like that. And then, given that one change in your information, ads will be targeted in very specific ways. And yeah, so it's a lot of the issues that we've been talking about here. I suspect my friend would have very wise things to say. You know, he'd stir the pot even harder than we can.
Oh, I think having, you know, guests on like that would be awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he'd be quite willing, actually.
I want to get back to this idea of personhood, but before I do, I want to share kind of an anecdote regarding that. And I ran an experiment in November.
Okay.
I guess it would be an unethical experiment.
What do you mean by experiment? I was going to say more.
But it was a bit of a social experiment that I enacted on my social group. And of course, I couldn't warn them beforehand because that would skew the results. But I wanted to see how much people have grown to trust the information presented to them online and through entities like Facebook. And Facebook was the one that I used it. And I realized it's not scientific or anything else. But I kind of had this hunch and I wanted to see what would happen. So back in October, I think it was, I changed the month of my birthday on Facebook to November 18th from April 18th. And that did not go over well with a lot of people. There were about three people that messaged me and said, dude, your birthday's in April. And I'm like, yeah, I know. Thank you. I actually had a friend. She took me out to a play and dinner and whatnot. And we went to dinner beforehand. And when I tried to pay for the bill or pay my share of the bill, no, I was going to pay the bill, sorry, because she had also paid for the show.
Sure.
And I tried to pay for the dinner and she wouldn't let me. And I'm like, you know, I appreciate this, but what's going on? Why won't you let me do this? And she said, well, it's your birthday tomorrow, right? So happy birthday. And I'm like, oh, shit.
Oh.
So I kind of had to tell her what was going on. She thought it was pretty funny. A lot of people didn't. I actually had quite a few friends who went off on me about it, saying that, you know, they felt violated and that the trust had been breached and they don't have good memories or whatever. No. And they rely on the information that I put in Facebook, especially about non-trivial things like a birth date, to be factually accurate. So the reason why I came about this, because I found that I'd actually forgotten a lot of people's birthdays, and I was just watching what Facebook was saying. And then I'd click that little birthday window, and it gives you the list of the five people whose day it is today.
Understood.
And you put in happy birthday, and I've been trying to at least put something different in every time. But
me too.
In all honesty, I don't know when anyone's birthday is anymore. I know when my family's is. That's about it.
Yep.
And it's always been like that. I've always relied on Outlook to let me know. Now people just put it on Facebook, and it's there. But, you know, I thought, okay, so how many people are depending on the veracity of the information that's posted online? What I wasn't prepared for was the negative reaction that I got and the sense of betrayal directed towards me. It wasn't even that the system had lied to them.
Do you know?
But I had lied to them through the system.
Right. But
And they felt that I was breaching a trust that they had between them and Facebook.
That's so.
Right? Because I'd manipulated the information that Facebook reported to them. So it wasn't, yes. I mean, I suppose I did, you know, breach the trust directly, but it's rather inconsequential. So whatever. With the exception of the person who buy me dinner.
That's so funny because I remember, because I honestly didn't remember that your birthday was in April, but I did think for a second, like I second guessed myself because I think I was one of the ones that sent you happy birthday on your wall. But I think, yeah, because I remember second guessing myself for a second going, I think I've seen your name pop up less than a year ago, but I couldn't remember clearly. And so here I am. But I actually in my head decided, correct me if I'm wrong, if there was text that I sent you to the contrary, but I remember deciding that Facebook had fucked up somehow with your information rather than you had. So that's interesting. That just lets me know, because I assume most of the time that most of my friends are not deliberately lying to my face, so to speak, my virtual face,
right?
You know, my pretty little picture on my Facebook.
I guess that brings an interesting ethical question too, like where is just the way that you phrased it too, that I was lying to your face, right? Like, so.
Well, no, I don't think you were. I assumed you weren't, right? That was.
But it's kind of part of how do we. I'm actually kind of scrolling through the Facebook here to try to find out what you did say.
Okay, fair enough.
But.
Knowing me, I give you a blessing of some sort. And then you were like, dude, it's not my birthday. And I probably said something like, oh, sorry.
But your language there is telling you, yeah, you might have sent it through private. It's not on my wall. But anyway.
Okay, fair enough. Lying to my face.
Yeah.
Is telling language.
That sounds very, very harsh, right? And that was the reaction that I got, was this betrayal. Now, to step back further, and again, we'll get back to this personhood thing, but this topic fascinates me. Number of years ago, I think I got married in 2006. Okay. And like 2007, 2008, we both had decided independently to change our marital status from married to it's complicated. Mm-hmm. I changed mine to it's complicated, and Thomas changed his to just none of your business. I'm not disclosing that information type of thing, because he's got coworkers and students that also follow him, right? Mm-hmm. I tend not to worry so much about that. But anyway, so what had happened is I had quite a few people call me, text me, email me, Facebook me saying, what happened? Would you guys get divorced? You know, we didn't realize things were wrong with the marriage. You just got married a year ago. Is everything okay? You know, we didn't see it coming. And I'm like, well, hold on here. All I did was click a dialogue. I mean, and my reaction was, I'm actually surprised that you feel that way. I mean, anyone who knows and I knows that we're open books, sometimes way too open. And
hence this project. No, that's a different discussion.
We've had to learn how to tone down our internal rhetoric around our friends and families. Let's just put it that way. But it surprised me that I guess I thought that if we were the type of people that were about to divorce, people would have seen that coming from a year away or a mile away. And the fact that it caught people off guard was interesting. I mean, it says a lot about how people perceive a relationship, but it also kind of struck me as odd of, especially some of the people who were saying this, they were very, very close friends. And I'd be like, don't you think that I would have told you before I published that online? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's not an accusation against them and whatnot.
Sure.
The strength of our relationship. It's just like, how open to manipulation are we leaving ourselves to Facebook? And Facebook in particular, but other such entities, whatever comes along, like used to be Friendster or MySpace, or before that it was other things. And maybe Facebook will endure and maybe it won't. But how open to manipulation are we allowing, leaving ourselves if we're trusting what the computer is telling us over what our own intuition or our own experience is saying?
Right.
Right. Then the reaction of anger towards the person when their information doesn't match up to what the computer says. And, yes. Whether or not it was deliberately manipulated by the person, or it was a database error, or some nefarious entity with malicious intent came and changed that information. What bothers me is that people don't question the trust relationship they have between Facebook and themselves.
Mm.
I'll stop talking.
It's interesting because one of my professors, he at Canadian Mennonite University in Winnipeg, his name is Paul Dick, and his research was on doctoral research was actually on the history of the book, like codexes and stuff like this, and so he part of his current research is about how people communicate in hypertextual sort of environments, okay, and sort of how personality and stuff like that is expressed in hypertext. And that just sort of got me thinking, because I kind of went to him at one point and I said, if we assume that our hypertextual environments are extensions of our bodies, that strikes me as somehow depersonalizing. And then the next place that my mind went to, based on what you just said, is this thing that I've encountered where your relationship really hasn't, your new romantic relationship hasn't started or hasn't finished until your romantic status has changed on Facebook. Yeah?
Let's elaborate on that a little bit, clarify.
Oh, okay. Well, I've just seen it where people will sort of, like, they'll have exactly the reaction that you described. Like, when I decided to take my relationship stuff off what people could see, I had several people, especially people in my family, because I guess Facebook told them something about a breakup, or I don't know what Facebook phrased it as, but it was, are you okay? And they were prepared to hear sob stories. If someone who I hadn't talked to in months was like, here's my cell number, call me anytime. And other friends of mine would go through similar situations where the joke was, it's not official until it's on Facebook. And then everyone will take, it's not official until it's on Facebook. And then everyone will take you seriously. So we'll know you're divorced, Will. You are divorced because Facebook told them so, and Facebook always tells the truth.
Right.
Yes. Facebook as a person, oddly how we've been talking about Facebook like a quasi-personal entity, even in this small part of the conversation. So Facebook, the corporation, always tells the truth.
But does it?
Unless they don't.
It raises two points for me. I think we're going to come back to this idea of personhood at some other point in time, corporate personhood. Maybe we should table that for some other time when maybe we could read up on it or maybe understand it better. Have somebody who knows what they're talking about come join us. I don't know. But I really like this idea, this whole Facebook thing. It's really kind of lit a fire under me. So I'm going to continue with it. And in rights, I'm sure, is kind of the underlying thing that is going to dominate most of our conversations. So, if you're amiable.
You can't see me, but I'm crossing myself. If most of the conversations we're going to have about rights, I imagine that I'll be gritting my teeth at various points because I don't actually affirm the existence of rights the way that we usually talk about them, as I just said.
Right.
But yes, so anyways, Lord save me now, as we might say in my tradition. I'm amiable. Don't worry about it. Whatever you want to come up with, go ahead. I'll be here for the fun.
Well, I think we could really, really delve deep into that. And I don't want to go too much closer to 8 o'clock. Like,
fair.
Up to 8 o'clock is kind of where I'm thinking, because people are going to listen to 2 hours anyway. Even if they're listening this far, God bless you. But
Facebook.
Facebook is a person. Facebook's our friend. Why would Facebook lie to us? Right? So... The two things that come, and you know, I never even thought about that personification or anthropomorphization of Facebook until you brought it up. But two things that did come to mind were, what is the perceived trustability, if that's even a word?
Trustworthiness.
Trustworthiness, yeah. Thank you. Of an individual who doesn't disclose appropriately on Facebook within a social network. And what I mean by that is, if you are removing stuff, or if you don't even disclose things to begin with, such as religious views, political views, age, marital status, you don't post much, how does that affect your trust with those in your social group? I find that I tend to be pretty tight with the people that I associate with, but I also vomit onto Facebook on a regular basis. There are those who don't, and I wonder if that, instead of not bringing people closer, actually causes a sense of distrust. I mean, I don't know. I'll let you comment on that.
That's really interesting, because this is just me speaking from my intuition. But whenever I see, because even some of my friends, even if they're, I see it more so in people who are between our age, sort of early 30s, and our parents' generation, who are on Facebook. Their information tends to be more focused, or they won't reveal a lot, or they'll drop the year of their birth from their birthday, yeah. You know, minor stuff like this. But there's also, whenever I assume, it's interesting, because I assume when I read a profile that's mostly empty, in terms of I don't have access to that information, I tend to assume that the person's primary social network is offline. And if I read a very full profile, their primary social network is online.
Okay.
Or they're more comfortable being amphibious, in terms of they just, it's a seamless sort of thing between in person and online, whereas people that sort of are more cagey with their information tend to make sharper distinctions. That's sort of what
cagey telling word, cagey.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I don't mean to factor into whatever question you're. I don't necessarily think that caginess is a bad thing, because I think that people that sort of keep their information tight, I don't assume they themselves are not trustworthy. I assume that they do not trust the systems that are carrying the information, and there's a difference.
Okay.
To me, because for crying out loud, like, there are cyberbullying and stuff like this has become a major issue in the last couple years. And so I can understand why people sort of want to limit the kinds of information they put online. I actually don't tend to assume that someone is untrustworthy. I tend to say something. My inner dialogue usually sounds like, that's an interesting story. That might be none of my business, but it's their story to tell. And I sort of leave it there. That's
along those lines.
Sure.
Or not.
Or not.
I have a tangentially related thought. Let me process that. I think that's a good idea. You know, that people choose to disclose. Now, I'm going to write down what I was thinking, because I want to come back to it.
Okay. What was the good thing about what people choose to disclose?
Well, okay, so you're talking about, you know, age groups tend to inform how people socialize online, and I would definitely agree with that. So Would you maybe have a greater degree of trust for somebody who was younger who disclosed more versus somebody who was younger who didn't?
I would assume for some reason, like... Okay, so if anyone from the Mennonite communities that I hung out with in Winnipeg are eventually going to eavesdrop on this, I apologize. But when I encounter younger men who I know are Mennonite on Facebook who do not disclose their sexual orientation, I tend to find that telling, because my sense of Mennonite community is that it can be socially difficult for Mennonite queers to be out. So most Mennonites I know will very clearly put their sexual orientation on their profiles. I don't know why this is. This was just what I noticed. This, I'm strictly speaking from intuition here. But so if I'm encountering that sort of person, you know, there's a yellow flag that goes up. But I wonder if there's a story about why they're not disclosing that information. I don't trust them less, but I hope they're okay in some sense, or I wonder why they didn't feel safe enough to disclose that information, because it seems pretty innocuous.
So you do factor into your perception of the person, maybe rightly or positively or negatively, but it does influence your perception of a person as to what they choose to disclose and not disclose.
Yes, but my perception can be altered in ways that don't have to do with their trustworthiness as a person.
Mm, fair enough.
Yeah. But yeah, I agree that the amount of information that I would be used to seeing if someone in my peer group, broadly speaking, online, doesn't disclose the sorts of information that most other people in my peer group do, I'm going to go, oh, I am very curious. At least I am very curious. What's the story there? So no dead air.
No dead air. Yeah, sorry. I'm thinking. I mean, you can see me. Nobody else can, right?
Yeah, yeah. So. No, I'm good with that, though, because I'm sitting there. You know, Will's got this funky blue thing on the mouth of his microphone, sitting there with this very focused, pensive expression. And I'm like, okay, so I should describe this. No dead air.
It's a good wake-up call. Say something.
Yes, politely, of course.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel compelled to comment on that, but I mean, I really don't have anything to say. It is what it is, as much as sure. That goes. But
sure,
I think just the whole concept of how we relate to people through this medium,
right?
And we think of it as one-on-one conversations with people, or group conversations, or we forget that the system itself is an intermediary, that, mm-hmm. you know, I'm sure we've all noticed it, where Facebook decides that we need to be friends with somebody again, and they start posting their, you know, it starts bringing mm-hmm. updates more into focus on your wall for whatever reason, and takes mm-hmm. other people away. By what means it does that, and you know what, I can say that it's definitely influenced, and I'll cop to it, as to how I socialize with people and who I socialize with. if people kind of disappear from Facebook, then it, they're just not top of mind, especially when there's always somebody else to step into place, and I'm being manipulated by an algorithm. And that's kind of scary, you know?
Hmm.
And I wonder how people deal with that, or I wonder what the effect of it is on people who don't even realize it's happening, let alone realize, but just kind of submit to it anyway.
But you just sort of shocked me, because in a way, it was the word intermediary that actually shocked me, because most of what I am doing from my doctoral work and a lot of thinking that I've done for years has to do with language, right, as an intermediary, and we structure, especially if we're typically, you know, if we use, for example, English as a first language, English is a worldview, right? Yeah. We don't get things without using English, and this is fine, but it's sort of the ocean that you swim in and you don't notice. And then Facebook, for me, until you said that, so I was just all of a sudden, I mentally one step back going, oh my goodness. But Facebook seems to be, for a lot of folks, including me in odd ways, this ocean that we swim in. So that I remember when you and I and Ducky, who still hasn't shown up yet, so we started going back and forth on some issues that felt rather loaded to me, at least emotionally. But it was, there came a point where I sort of had to say, I hope that there's a distinction between this conversation and our friendship, because I'm not quite sure how to interpret. But I remember that made a comment right at the beginning about this, and another friend of ours sort of made the same comment about this feels a lot like high school, and we're sitting around the table and we're, you know, chatting about stuff. And so that sense of someone's Facebook wall can become the group conversation, as though I'm sitting there looking at your face, because that's the simulation, right? Is I'm looking at your face.
Very much. Yeah.
But that is an intermediary that we don't think about the fact that we speak English, and we don't think about the fact that we're using Facebook. And Facebook especially, my Facebook profile is not an extension of myself. I use it, or I hope I use it, but it's not my personal identity. People will find out a lot about me on my Facebook profile, but I hope to God they won't assume, you know, if you haven't heard my voice before, I guarantee you, you'll get my voice wrong in your head reading what I write on Facebook. And it's not because I have a very different voice when I write, it's just that I've had the experience over and over and over again of people meeting me for the first time and saying, your writing doesn't sound anything like your speaking voice, but now that I've heard your speaking voice, I can now interpret everything else that you said correctly. I'm putting it in quotes beside my head. So
can see that, yeah.
Yeah, so it actually sort of scares me. That Facebook, I think the thing that people don't notice, you commented earlier about, I wonder what happens to people that they don't even notice that Facebook is the intermediary. My intuition wants to go somewhere really scary, which is their Facebook profile is an extension of them. It's like a virtual extension of their body. And if they lost their Facebook. Yeah, I think so. Sorry, I didn't remember the technical term. But yeah, they treat the Facebook as an avatar, and people would be, if Facebook just went poof, like all their servers crashed, or I don't even know if that's possible, but Facebook just disappeared. Right? I'm talking to an IT guy who's now laughing into the camera because I don't even have proper layman's terms. But Facebook disappears.
No. You know what? My reaction wasn't about that. It was the social consequence of it. Who uses MSN anymore? Who uses ICQ anymore? Who uses email? I mean, even text messaging and everything.
I like email. I write emails. Oh. I would like our listeners to know that I love writing real emails.
Yeah, but those are letters. Those are snail mails. They're not, you know what I mean? It's my primary source of community connection, whether it be with my friends or family. Even my mother now is either through text messaging or Facebook. And now that I'm no longer using an iPhone, Facebook has become the
not using an iPhone?
I know, what? Scandalous.
Scandal. Says the one whose phone is so old school it's not even smart enough to send pictures. Okay, that's, you know. So
but you know, my entire social group was pretty much using iPhones, so we became, you know, iMessage was the thing, right?
Sure.
And now that I don't have that capability, we've all kind of had to move that activity over through Facebook's messaging and chats.
Sure.
Chat thing. So if they go, oh my God, like, and I have no means of getting a hold of him except through Facebook. And I've known this guy longer than I've known you.
Yeah. That sort of the
because that, like you said, okay, I'm glad you weren't laughing at me for my lack of technical know-how in terms of IP stuff, IT stuff rather. But yeah, I think, because there are things, there are tiny thoughts, and I try, the reason why some of my Facebook statuses are so short is because I don't really mind if I lose them. But I really wonder, people who post hundreds of pictures because they document their lives and sort of allow people to visually eavesdrop, if you want to put it that way. And then their avatar, their Facebook page, dies because Facebook disappears. I think some of the social consequences, I wonder if some people would honestly react as though somebody had been killed or a pet had died. Or what happens when you're a writer and you've got 2 years worth of writing and everything crashes and you forgot to, no, this sort of reaction. And then you realize about 2 weeks later, if you're like me, when my computer crashed and ate most of my papers for 5 years, you realize that you're still alive, but it's, which is a weird way to put it, but for me, I wonder how shocking it would be. I wonder if people would behave as though a piece of themselves had died or they'd lost a limb, metaphorically speaking.
Right.
I don't know. I do not know. But I think the level of shock for some people, if Facebook were to die, my roommate sends me a Gmail chat message. He says, Facebook offers a backup function. Smiley tongue face.
It does, but it doesn't. It allows you to archive your data, but it doesn't allow you to replace it as that intermediary. It's the coffee table, right? It's that, you know, I may lose everything I've ever written or posted, but then that means my ability to connect and stay connected with people who I may be in contact with, like, on an hourly basis. There are some people at school, I'm at Mount Royal University in a computer information systems degree, and I run a number of clubs and involved with the Students Association. So there's stuff that I'm pretty close to, and we're in constant daily contact with each other.
On Facebook?
Facebook. You know, and it's for our groups. That's how we organize our groups and whatnot. So what type of disruption? Yeah, sure. You keep the data, but that's almost ancillary, right? Like how, what then becomes the medium by like, oh my God, I got to pick up a phone. I'm getting rid of my home phone. And in all honesty, if I had the option, I wouldn't even have voice minutes on my phone. I don't want to talk to people, you know, I'd rather text them because it's, telephone conversations are on demand and they're not respectful of the other person's time, right? They're the leash that we pull and yank to each other. Whereas text messages, and I'm not saying that it's a horrible thing, but whereas text messages allow people to deal with the information and the communication when it's convenient and pertinent to them.
For sure. I'm just laughing because you probably remember from quite a few different conversations over the years that I love stuff about personality theory, some Myers-Briggs and that sort of stuff. So I'm like, you sound like an introvert. But the thing is, like, I absolutely agree with you that the only way, like, I had to do a lot of thinking before getting a cell phone, and I did it for two reasons. One, I was in Toronto, and sometimes for me it's a safety thing, given that I live with cerebral palsy, and one of the effects that's been documented for my brain is that spatial orientation is compromised. So spatial orientation is what lets you get from point A to point B and map things in your head and sort of, I'm moving west rather than east and all this sort of stuff. So if everybody knows what a percentile is, mine is in the fifth percentile, meaning 94 people out of 100 will do mapping tasks better than I do. So if I'm in some neighborhood in Toronto and don't know where I am, cell phone is my best friend. The second thing is just, you know, being connected, but I refused. And until I sort of figured out how to do it for myself, the reason why I refused to have a cell phone was because I didn't want the yanking leash sort of effect, because I see it in most of my friends.
Absolutely.
They feel obligated. Their cell phone is on their hip and it goes off and they feel obligated 100% of the time to pick it up. And I'm like, no, the technology does not control you. You control it. Okay.
Oh, that's the worst, when you're talking to somebody and their phone goes off and they reach for it and they go silent. Oh, that, you know, that pisses me off to the point now where I just like, okay, conversation's over. Like, I don't know what it is.
If someone's phone rings and they don't go for it though, do you just sort of ride out the ring and let it go to voicemail, or is the conversation
silenced or whatever? You know, if somebody says, you know what, I really need to get this, I'm expecting it, it's important, blah blah blah, fine, whatever. But if, you know, me and you're sitting at Denny's having a conversation, or it doesn't have to be Denny's, but you know,
yes,
Denny's may seem
more acceptable.
We are not
acceptable. A slave to corporate logos.
But you know, even if it were the Keg or you know, some other upscale chain, and it gets worse the higher upscale that my meal costs, right? Like if I'm paying $10, I might tolerate it more than if I'm paying $50 for my pork cooked steak.
Sure.
But even then, it's frustrating, because when people do that, and my husband does it all the time, unfortunately, I don't have the luxury of walking out on him. But when people do that, the message that I get from that action is I am as engaged in your conversation and this experience up until the point that the demands of a random person. You know what I mean? So I'm obviously not able to hold your attention if something that you don't even know who it is and what they want is enough to pull you away from it, especially in the middle of speech.
Yes.
Right?
And see, that to me is the danger that I tried to flag for my professor about if we take cell phones or we take texting or we take hypertext as uncomplicated extensions of ourselves, we risk preferring the impersonal or the instantaneous sort of leash jerk. And I agree with you that I think actual live sit down over food, we can have another conversation sometime about how important I think food is to the human community, okay, and day-to-day conversation. But sitting down face to face and my old friend, I haven't seen you in years, let's go, you know, is more important to me. And I think a great many people, if we were really honest with ourselves, it's more important to us to have that conversation. And yet here's the technology that we haven't managed to integrate properly. And it's very, my friend Maddie, the human rights scholar, would say, it's very ungrounded, he would say. And I think I agree with him.
I
hope you hear me strongly agreeing with you, is my point in that little
sermon.
Okay.
And I'm a slave to my phone. I mean, I got ticked off enough at Rogers that I marched straight over to Bell. But, okay, that made no sense. But anyway, my point was I couldn't give it up if I wanted to. And trust me, I do want to.
Right.
But I use it to the point where my cell phone bills were getting too high that I had to find
another provider that would give you
who could accommodate my demands, even though
I don't want to be
in this thing, right?
Sure.
So as a prolific user, I still make sure that my phone is on vibrate or silent. I don't like the ringer going off, because I don't want people to feel that random interruption is something that I feel obligated, you know? Like, I don't want anyone to say, are you going to get that? I'm like, no,
right.
I'm here with you. I'm present with you. The intentionality of this action is with you.
Yes.
Just because somebody knows how to push send does not, you know, and really the only person who could actually have anything to say that's worth interrupting something is, you know, a life and death thing. And that's kind of my thing. If it's an emergency, then they should be calling 911. Otherwise, there's voicemail. and they can leave a message, which people don't for whatever reason, but or they can send a text message.
I don't
message.
Understand that, but never mind. People don't leave messages when you clearly ask on this machine, and I realize it's a virtual voice, but would you please leave a message?
My brother does that. He'll call and he won't leave a message. I've been trying to get a hold of you. I'm like, well, then leave a message and I'll return it. But anyway, it's kind of the only time that I'll accept being interrupted in the state of an emergency is, you know, if it is my husband trying to get me and he, through the phone, is able to override the silent switch and do that remotely so that it is brought to my immediate attention, then I know it's serious. But
sure.
You know, that's something that we rarely use, and it's generally to wake me up because I've slept in and I'm missing class, which I never, ever, ever do.
I was going to say normal human error when you're a student. Somehow this conversation, again, and maybe this is me making a leap that isn't quite obvious, but again, I think in the back of my head lately, and for future reference, if we ever edit this and people are listening to episode zero, like some really awful things, at least culturally in North America, have happened in the last few weeks. I'm thinking, you know, the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, and right now, at this point in Canadian history, there's a native, an Aboriginal chief who's on hunger strike, wanting a meeting with high-level government officials. So this sort of thing about being present and not making assumptions and having priorities for each other when we're actually physically present to each other strikes me as really important. And then getting back to, you know, humanity and rights and stuff, and then we want to talk about corporate personhood. Okay. And I'm just like, no. So I really, there's something in my heart that just grabs a lot of what you say about, you know, I'm present here with you, and barring a life or death emergency, or I've slept through my alarm clock and need to get back into student mode, those very human conversations are lost because we're thinking at levels of abstraction or at one level or two levels of removal. Don't actually help necessary conversations, or we want to talk about human rights or people having appropriate resources, and you can't provide those things if you're not physically present to do it. Anyway, that might seem like a loaded sort of thing, but so for me, intuitively, this conversation has now come full circle. Because I think what you said about presence is key to a whole lot of things that our society gets wrong about rights and privileges and how to manage things and people. So that was me being quasi-profound. I did not succeed.
You might want to elaborate a little more for the benefit of those who aren't on track.
Ask me.
Okay, so tying, and maybe it's my own ignorance, but, you know, we'll go with the assumption whenever we do this that if one of us has a question, 1,000 of us have a question, even though nobody's listening. But whatever. At this moment, we're not broadcasting, let's put it that way.
Yes, indeed.
We're recording
episode
it.
Episode zero. Yes.
So you're talking about intentionality of presence and rights and how we're getting that wrong.
Yeah. I think
flesh that out a little more.
I think we're getting it wrong. Well, because like we're talking about corporate personhood.
Right.
I'm not a complete cynic because I do understand that society needs structures.
Yes.
But when corporations go wrong, how do you resist them? Who do you talk to? How do you hold them to account? How do you say to a corporation, "Hey, asshole, you just stabbed me in the eye. You're causing harm. your trains have just crashed into each other, and now there's 1,700 liters of unfiltered diesel oil spilling onto my reserve.
Right.
Okay? But there are no faces. And the faces who show up are following orders or don't have enough authority and the conversations that need to happen are not happening because we're interested in giving more time to figuring out how corporations can bilk us of our money and privacy and whatever else, rather than actually dealing with human problems. And you're sitting there laughing. No, that's okay. It's all good. But anyways, so here I am being a bleeding liberal, I'm pretty sure, but there.
I can't say that I necessarily agree with you on that last statement.
Sorry, so what do you disagree with me on?
That you know, we're sitting on our laurels waiting for the clock to run out on how much they can rape us.
Well, I'm glad we're not sometimes, but it certainly seems like we're far more interested. I don't know who we is, and that's the problem with my statement.
I think it comes back to the structure of corporate personhood trying to be something that it can't be, trying to take the place of a flesh and blood human as a natural person, as would be called legally, versus a
An
unnatural person, which would be a corporation. So, you know, a natural person has ability for conscience and whatnot that a corporation is legally mandated not to have. So a corporate charter requires that a corporation act in the financial best interest of its shareholders at all times. Mm-hmm. Right? It's driven exclusively by the profit motive. Whereas we can say as individuals, you know, that's not a value I want, that I want to be able to have that ability for gray in my life and say that I don't need $1,000 if, you know, maybe I will let go $700 of profit because this is the morality of this choice means more than the profit of the choice. Mm-hmm. Legally, businesses don't have that option. And there is an interesting concept coming out in the United States, and I can't remember exactly what it's called, but it's kind of a hybrid between the for-profit and non-profit, where you're allowed to set out and operate under for-profit rules, but you're not necessarily obligated to have a year-over-year quarter-after-quarter profit.
Okay, sure.
So that the profits of your business are allowed to be direct to a specified community good versus, you know, the benefit of the investor shareholders.
Sure.
So that's something that,
you know, I didn't realize that, but that's straight. Oh man. So many, I'm glad there's the middle option now that's emerging. Cause I just have so many in the past 5 years or so, serious problems with legally obligating companies to always answer to their shareholders and to no other considerations. Right. I'll use the economic metaphor deliberately, morally bankrupt sort of way of doing things.
Have you watched the Canadian, I might add, documentary, The Corporation?
I have not.
It's available on Netflix. And maybe we should kind of come back to this idea of personhood and alternative corporate structures to give us some time to do some research. I'm just looking at the clock.
Absolutely.
About 90 minutes in, so we've probably lost a lot of people. And
this is assuming we don't edit this one. And then,
right.
You know.
Well, that word will probably go. But, it's...
Nobody expects the Anglican Inquisition.
I like where this conversation is happening, and I'm sure that we could go on for a while, but I just don't want to exhaust. I mean, I think we've proved in the concept that there are many rabbit holes we will travel. And I would suggest that The Corporation is a good documentary to watch.
Okay.
The point of The Corporation is looking at it from the legal point of view and comparing it against what the DSM-IV lays out as the symptoms or the qualifications to be diagnosed as a psychopath. And they make the argument that it lines up. So
That's fascinating. Okay.
That might give you some fodder, and then we can also look into this alternative corporate structure and get back into this conversation of personhood and in human rights and whatnot.
I'm sure there will be plenty more times to do this sort of thing, hopefully with Ducky here.
Yeah, it's too bad he didn't show up. So that's kind of where I would like to leave things. Maybe if next week we can jump on board with this, the corporations and personhood and whatnot. And I will try to get this posted online so we could probably get 3 people to download it and maybe get some feedback.
There will be more than 3 because, like, for example, my friend Maddie, who's been referred to 3 or 4 times on my part, will probably be like, "Ooh, you mentioned my name. I want to hear it."
A little ego surfing there, eh?
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Hey, Maddie, what's up?
So, well, then let's wrap that up and we'll set that as the plan. I think this was a good episode 0.
Yes, indeed.
I think I figured out what's kind of going on with your mic. It's a setting in Skype, but we'll deal with that later.
Okay.
And because I
fixed it. Good to have an IT guy on your side, folks.
And so I'm excited. Excellent. I think that we have, you know, at least a good 2 or 3 episodes ahead.
Yeah.
Just of the fodder that we've dug up today and, you know, sure to throw a wrench into things. So
has he got anything but wrenches? Anyway.
Yeah, hand grenades and stuff. No, you know what? I love the guy. He's between the two of you. You keep me on my toes and you keep me intellectually and emotionally honest. And that's what I really appreciate about you. So. What did I tell you? Last 5 minutes.
Oh,
do you see that?
He's right here.
He just showed up.
He just showed up.
Is he going to jump in the chat? I hear I'm yelling and people are like, "I thought you were going offline." But yeah, maybe he'll jump in here. Let's see. I just saw him log into Skype, just logged into Facebook.
We'll let him say hello and then we'll, you know, do our, and this is, you know, this is the inaugural episode of Hardly Qualified signing off. Whatever.
2 hours late, my friend.
Two hours late, yes. Side effect of taking a sleeping pill 10 hours ago. 12 hours ago.
Well, we... Jason, do you want to introduce yourself? We're just finishing up episode 0.
Episode 0, yay.
What did I tell you? I said last 5 minutes he's going to show up, didn't I?
He did a few.
Why didn't you phone me, man?
I don't have your phone number.
Really?
Which also came up as part of a conversation, but, you know.
Send it to me through Facebook, and then I'll put it in my
here.
Magic device, and then we'll have it done. Why don't we all say goodbye, and we'll end this episode. And you know what? If you guys want to start another one right afterwards, I'm for that. But I think that we should cut off here just for the sake of what people are going to be willing to sit through.
Yeah.
So I'm William.
I'm Rob.
And I don't want to use my name. I'm Angry Duck.
You want to be Angry Duck? Well, we've been referring to you as throughout this whole thing. So.
Well, good thing this is a practice run, right?
I guess we can bleep some of it out. All right, well, we'll see.
See, hardly qualified. I can't even fucking show up on time.